Dogfight is a narrative poem interrupted regularly by other poems and occasionally by what Calvin Trillin calls a pause for prose. With the same barbed wit he displayed in his bestsellers Deciding the Next Decider, Obliviously On He Sails, and A Heck of a Job, America's deadline poet has now trained his sights on the Tea Party and the slapstick field of contenders for the Republican nomination. There is an ode to Michelle Bachmann sung to the tune of a Beatles classic. Michelle Arbel thinks that gays will all be sent to hell. And passages on the exit of candidates like Herman Cain as well as Rick Santorum. It is a wonderful sort of best of collection of the 2012 presidential campaign. A longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, Calvin Trillin is also the nation's deadline poet. His acclaimed books range from Memoir About Alice to Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 years of funny stuff. And it's a great pleasure to welcome one of my literary heroes, Calvin Trillin, back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure when you're on the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I love when you're here. Give us a sense. Time crept up on me. I remember when the first volume of these came out, but you've been doing this since 1990, this deadline poetry.
I've been doing the deadline poetry in the nation since 1990, yes. And this has some of the poems I've done in the last few months for the campaign, but the spine of it is a long, well, let's not be afraid of the word epic here, epic poem.
It is an epic poem.
Yeah, it's sort of epic. And as you say, it's interrupted by by shorter poems, some of which have been in the nation, and by prose. The first pause for prose, I think, is entitled Callista Gingrich, aware that her husband has cheated on and left two seriously ill wives, desperately tries to make light of a bad cough.
when you take this on, so this is when you work on this, is this something that comes day-to-day during the campaign? In the sense of that it is a deadline thing, where it is of the moment, and then it sort of comes together at the end of the campaign, I would think.
Well, for the weekly poems in the nation, I just set the showerhead to iambic pentameter on Sunday nights, and something comes out for Monday morning. But for the long poem that's new to the book, I wrote most of it in the summer, so I sort of kept track and actually kept a little clipping file in the old-fashioned way in the spring, and then wrote most of it over the summer, and I just turned the last chapter in about 2 days after the election, and the next week we had books, so I told my editor I'd take back almost everything I've said about the inefficiency of the publishing industry. I'd like to hold a few thoughts in reserve, but
certainly understood. When you think of because I remember you saying and correct me if I'm wrong here, but this all ultimately began with the name of one particular politician, Sununu.
Absolutely, I think I'm not here to boast, Joe, but I think that I am the only person ever inspired to poetry by John Sununu.
I would think maybe that's true.
This was the John Sununu, not the senator, but his father, who was the chief of staff for George H.W. Bush,
right,
and reappeared in this campaign talk about the fact that Obama should become American or something like that. But at any rate, the George H.W. Bush administration was sort of a gray time for those of us in the small joke trade, because it was very bland and there weren't any really juicy scandals. And there was just these kind of quiet Ivy League gentlemen in suits. And the only standout was John Sununu, who wasn't even shaped like the rest of them, and also had that characteristic that attracts the attention of people like me, which is that he was intent on showing that he was the smartest person in the room. And I think Ed Rollins, who in this last campaign managed Michelle Bachmann's campaign, said that John Sununu was an argument against telling your child that he has a high IQ. And then I love that name, Sununu, Sununu. And I used to murmur it, particularly on the subway, Sununu, Sununu. And I finally wrote a poem called If You Knew What Sununu. That was my first deadline poem.
I remember Johnny Carson, before he went off the air, did one of his final Karnak bits. Was he took the card and he put it to his forehead and he said, Sununu, and then he opened it up and the answer was the sound a goat makes when it falls down an escalator. And I always, always remembered that. And there's something about that name that is very infectious.
The name. That's a beautiful name, I think. It's very euphonious.
Yes. Lovely. So
inspirational.
But not everybody has a Sununu. So when you take on a project like that of becoming a deadline poet, you sort of have to search for things that work for you, I assume.
Well, and also there's a great disadvantage is that something you're working against is that people whose names are not good for rhyme or meter persist in going into American politics. Without a thought of what it does to my verse. So, one of the things that I was most worried about, it seems odd now, but in 2008, one of the names actually mentioned by the great mentioners when they started mentioning who might be the Democratic candidate in the year that Obama eventually did become the Democratic candidate, one of the people they mentioned was the governor then of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich. Well, I was terrified that Rod Blagojevich would become the nominee because that name. But then later I found that it wasn't a bad rhyme. I did a poem called On the Auctioning Off of Barack Obama's Senate Seat, which goes, it seemed to Rod Blagojevich a powerful appointment which was his to make should make him rich. His plan turned out to have a glitch. Perhaps the feds had flipped a snitch. So much for Rod Blagojevich.
That's great. That's fantastic. But you wouldn't want to do it too often, right? You wouldn't want to have him as something that you would have to...
I think that pretty much did it for Blagojevich. Yeah. You can use up rhymes. I mean, for instance, Obama has actually, even though he occasionally jokes about having a funny name, it wasn't a bad rhyme, except I used up all the rhymes with Osama bin Laden. Yokohama, slap your mama, all of those rhymes. So
yeah.
And the nice iambic candidates like Ross Perot and John McCain never seemed to win.
And Romney would have been...
Well, Romney was a problem, and it occurred to me, actually, after I finished the book, what would I have done if, when the baby was born, Mr. and Mrs. Romney, his parents, who named the baby Willard Mitt Romney, had decided to call him Willard instead of Mitt. I would have been really, I mean, without a thought of what would have happened to me years later, they would have done this decision. So Mitt turned out to be fine, but Willard would have been a problem.
when we talk about this poetry on deadline, what is your deadline?
I usually turn in the poems on Monday. For the book, what I did was sort of set a goal of trying to write a certain number of lines a day, and around the end of the summer I caught up with what was happening, and I was writing in real time, so then I could sort of even daily follow the campaign, although there were still people there whose names weren't good, but you know, you can often get around that. You remember Senator DeMoto, Al DeMoto?
Yes.
who was often accused of being corrupt. I found D'Amato didn't rhyme with much. It people say, well, it rhymes with tomato, but I'm from Kansas City, and I can't really say tomato, but I found that it rhymes with sleazeball obligato.
Which is much more Kansas City.
Yes.
When you think, well, okay, maybe this name won't work, but then events come along and things happen within the course of the campaign that lend themselves. I was reading some things early on in the introduction, but as far as the early on in our show, you had some great lines from the Republican convention about Clint Eastwood and so forth. I mean, so different things would happen that would allow you to come up with great lines.
Well, yeah, the Republican convention was a good and then Romney, of course, was interesting for anybody. For instance, I did a poem. Remember when he went to Michigan, his home state, and he said, "I love this state. It seems right here. The trees are the right height." And I did a poem that was, "Away from here I find no trees that please, no trees at such a perfect height as these. For me I cannot ever be at ease with trees that grow no higher than one's knees, or two tall trees that splinter in a freeze. Wisconsin sure has bragging rights on cheese, and California's rich in Cantonese, and Colorado's where to take your skis. Connecticut, of course, has Lyme disease. And none of these am I prepared to sneeze, but here we have the perfect height of trees. I know that I will never see a sight as lovely as a tree whose height is right." He was a good candidate for that, because he was so awkward with people. Toward the end of one of the chapters, it said, "At retail politics, we'd seen no more ham-handed candidates since Albert Gore." I once, by the way, referred to Albert Gore in a poem as a man-like object. "Without the common touch that was, say, Truman's, Mitt didn't seem quite comfortable with humans. His small talk with the citizens appeared to be not only very small, but weird. Weird facts with no connection in his chatter, and questions to which answers didn't matter." So he was a good person to talk about in the campaign, and at first I was a little concerned that that there was only going to be one primary fight. Obama already had the nomination for the Democrats, and in 2008 I had both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Right.
But then the Republican field turned out to be so colorful that it wasn't any problem. I said, though first-tier candidates were mostly out, Republicans were asking, what about the second tier, or what about the third? Has nothing from those other tiers been heard? So we had sort of a clown parade that was, I'm not sure if it's good for the country, but it was good for those of us in the small joke trade. we often say about things like that, well, it's a pity. We're sort of like dentists in tooth decay. It's a pity, but where would business be without it?
You've used the term a couple of times this morning about the small joke trade. How would you define that?
Well, as those of us, I'm sometimes asked, aren't you ashamed of yourself for making a living by making snide, underhanded remarks about respectable public servants, and my only defense is, it's not much of a living.
So, is the of your work with the New Yorker and the books and so forth? I mean, that's obviously more than the small joke trade.
Well, that's when I have on what my daughters call my boy reporter hat, and I guess most of what I think if you added up the words over the years, most of them would be about, would be in relatively serious New Yorker reporting pieces. But this is the the small joke end of what I do. I've never quite, I mean, the publisher puts out releases saying I'm very versatile, which is another way of saying I never quite got my act together.
Well, it could be. I mean, you enjoy these various, I assume you enjoy playing with language, that is something that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, I've always liked that, and I've always written light verse, but what I call special occasion verse, you know, the sort of thing you hear at the rehearsal dinner or a special wedding anniversary, something like that. I'm actually a second generation poet. My father was a grocer for most of his working life, but he had a restaurant for a while. And he put a couplet on the menu every day at lunch, usually about pie, like, "Don't sigh, eat pie." That was his shortest poem. Not as short as my shortest poem, which was the political, philosophical, and societal implications of the O.J. Simpson trial. And the poem was, "O.J., oy vey." But still, "Don't sigh, eat pie" was a short poem. And he rhymed pie with "evening is nigh" and "all right, warden, I'm ready to fry. I've had my last piece of Mrs. Trillin's pie." And, my favorite poem of his was, "Eat your food, Mom said gently to her little son, Roddy. If you don't, I'll break every bone in your body."
It's very touching.
Yes, he wasn't much on meter, my father, but he was strict about rhyme.
When you think about your career and as you say, the versatility, you know, one of my favorite, I've been a longtime fan of your work, but Tepper Isn't Going Out was a very, very funny novel. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that was your last novel, right?
That's right. And again, not to be boastful on your show, but we believe it's the first parking novel ever written.
It was a fantastic book about a guy who has a good space and doesn't want to leave it.
That's right, Tepper. And I don't think there's been another parking novel since, either. There hasn't been a big bandwagon of people trying to do parking novels, copycat parking novels. I think it may remain the only parking novel ever written.
And you can be proud in that, I assume.
Yeah, you grasp at what honors you get, even if they don't sound good. I mean, at Southwest High School in 1953, and I was named third most likely to succeed. And I mention that often, even though when you think about it, third most likely to succeed is already failing, right? It's the first most likely to succeed you want.
Yeah, I assume that's true. You're still up there, though. Being considered,
yeah,
I guess.
Mentioned. Yeah. Mention's always appreciated.
When you, are you the kind of person and kind of writer who always has a novel in them, or is it working on something, or is that a very labored process for you?
I don't write novels naturally. I've only written three comic novels, and the first one I even hesitated to call a novel that it lacked. I used to call it, when I was working on it, the fiction thing. Since I didn't do description and character development and all that sissy stuff, and my wife said I would be called a fiction thingist. So I decided, well, maybe it's a novel, but I don't do it naturally. I have to sort of put it together. And some novelists, some really good novelists, you have the feeling they probably had that sort of stuff in them since they were 10 or 12 years old or something. I really don't, but occasionally I come up with some scheme for a novel.
And you were writing about food and eating before it became the thing, before the term foodie came about. You were out there doing that.
Well, that started as for 15 years, I did a piece for the New Yorker every 3 weeks from somewhere in the United States. And that came partly, well, from the fact that I was always in a strange city looking for someplace decent to eat. And also, I sort of needed a comic relief. Most of them were about controversies or murders or something. And occasionally, I would go to some place like the Brobridge Crawfish Festival and write about. But I don't actually know anything about food. I always wrote about it to tell jokes or to write about something else. But of course, I still would get questions from people about, you know, where the second best French restaurant was in Chicago or something. I always said that I was an example of how easy it is to be considered an expert in this country. If you keep saying, I don't know anything about this, it doesn't do any good.
And they asked you about the second best. Here again, the third most likely to succeed.
Maybe they knew I was only third most likely to succeed. Yeah, that's right. Nobody asked me about the first best.
Calvin Trillin is author of Dogfight, the 2012 Presidential Campaign in Verse. It is a delightful volume that is published by Random House. Calvin Trillin, I love having you on the program. I wish you a very, very happy holiday season, and I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks. Same to you, Joe.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Calvin Trillin is the author of Dogfight, the 2012 Presidential Campaign in Verse, published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.